We're going to open it up for Q&A. If I could have our speakers kind of come to the front, you can grab your chair. Just like to mention, some of our speakers had talked about the ag and nutrition linkages and also about gender. Just last week, the Feed the Future Gender Global Evidence Exchange took place. We'll have some of those materials up on AgriLinks. And then also up on AgriLinks is the event announcement for the upcoming Ag and Nutrition Global Evidence Exchange, or GLEE, that will be happening here in D.C. On June 18th. So if you're interested in that, check that out. We'll be taking questions from in-person and online. Do we have questions?
Thanks. Kelly O'Connell, IFTC. Thank you very much for the presentations. My question is related to gender, actually. You had mentioned that the asset gap between men and women is contributing to the income disparity in horticulture. I'm wondering if you see extension systems or the private sector playing a role in closing that asset gap and what role they're playing.
Hmm. That's a great question. Through my experience, we've seen that extension can play a role in trying to help close that gap, but oftentimes there are sometimes barriers in terms of the type of extension personnel that you have. So if we had greater numbers of female extension agents in certain places, I think that would facilitate training of women farmers, particularly in certain cultures. That's an issue. That's something I could say to address that topic. In terms of private sector, maybe, I don't know, maybe Don would want to address that one.
I mean, we find that that asset gap is often a resource gap. As Beth was saying, extension services which have a larger number of women are certainly important. That's certainly the case in both Tajikistan and in Liberia on our projects to access women's organizations. But by far the bigger issue is how to get lower risk finance to those women. And most of the projects, certainly under Feed the Future, involve direct transfers via grants into these organizations, so a capital asset transfer. But then you have the question of how do you generate the source of financing and refinancing on an annual basis so that those capital assets can be maintained and their use can spread through an entire area. And then that becomes one of those systemic issues that we spend a lot of time working on how to structure both the knowledge of microfinance institutions or banks, insurance companies, which often have to cover chunks of that financial risk, so that you can maintain the quality of the assets that are transferred through grant programs into the systems, and build the structure that is refinanceable through the financial institutions, rather than requiring a constant replenishment of grant funding.
We have a question from online.
Yes. So there was a number of questions relating to CoolBot technology, and Beth, your colleagues Britta, Brenda, and Amanda are all online, so they've taken a first stab at answering some of them. But the first one was from Naidu Rayapati from Washington State University, who asked, how successful is CoolBot technology when electricity is a rare commodity? And Philippe Chabot, an FAA consultant in D.C., expanded on that by asking, what is the power requirements for the CoolBot in terms of kilowatt hours? And would it be feasible with solar or a small generator? With cooling, with the evapotranspiration technology, the external power requirement is zero. Just curious to know how much power the CoolBot actually needs.
Great questions. Let's see. Try and take these in order. So in areas where there's no electricity, of course, the CoolBot is more of a challenge. We are looking at solar powering the CoolBot, and particularly looking at the types of air conditioned units that you can use with solar power. There's some newer units. I'm not up on all the engineering, but there's some newer units that don't require as much energy input to start the unit at the beginning that work better with solar power. And so we're working with our leader of innovation, Michael Reed, to explore the different options for solar powering the CoolBot, which would be very important. The reason we think, particularly in humid climates, we think the CoolBot is worth pursuing as compared to evaporative cooling is that the data we've been able to collect really shows that you're very limited with the amount of cooling you can get with an evaporative cooler. It may be 8 degrees differential from outside temperatures if under good conditions. And so for many crops, potato is a great example, that's really not going to give you a great extension of shelf life or improvement of quality. And so particularly for the really humid climates, we think exploring other technologies is worthwhile.
My name is Omar Dari from APTA Associates. Thank you for the three talks, but I would like to ask a question to you. The vegetables are the main sources of vitamin C and provitamin A. The other vitamins we can get from the whole cereals of the legumes. With these two vitamins, they are sensitive to sun drying and to cooking. In your experiments, how do they behave? Comparing the traditional vegetables with the wild vegetables in Africa that you presented?
That's a very good question. Unfortunately, I don't have the answer yet because we haven't completed those studies, so that part, the cooking part of that project, hasn't taken place. Certainly, there is loss of nutrients with any kind of drying or cooking strategy, but and we want to try to determine which cooking processes might better preserve nutrients. And we know, for example, boiling vegetables in water, you leach out a lot of vegetables, so steaming actually preserves more nutrients. So we hope to gain that sort of information with the African indigenous vegetable work that we're doing. Still the level of nutrients retained even in a cooked product, I think, are beneficial to the diet. So it's not that you're losing all the nutrients, but of course we want to maintain as many as possible.
We have a question from online.
Yes, this one comes from Don Greenberg, IFAD consultant in Istanbul. He says that many of us are practitioners, not researchers, and are interested in the economics of these technologies. Some very interesting examples have been presented from both Innovation Lab presentations. Would you please provide the cost or economics behind a few of them, or where we might be able to find more detailed information?
You want to take it?
Which one?
You want to talk about some of the cost economics?
You know, so far, as I presented in my talk, that we have analyzed 9 technologies that we introduced from the IPM Innovation Lab in different countries. For example, the papaya mealybug control, there the cost probably were less than $500,000. But the benefit has been anywhere from $500 to $1.7 billion. So that was one of the very classical ones that we got. In others, like introduction of the grafting technology, there the cost might have been about $1 million, and the benefit has been about anywhere from $30 to $40 million. And still we are expanding or introducing that technology to different countries. So far we have unleashed only one or two countries, especially in Bangladesh we have done that one. So we need to do the analysis, cost benefit analysis or the impact analysis in other countries.
In terms of some of the technologies I mentioned from the Horticulture Innovation Lab, if you go to our website, you can find information about their fact sheets on many of these technologies. And for those here in this audience, there's a handout out front that has a link to some of those handouts. We are working to get more local information about what air conditioners cost, what construction materials cost to build a CoolBot, for example. on the drying beads were developing different strategies for how they might be implemented commercially. So, for example, one strategy might be an entrepreneur starts a business in a community where he invests in some beads and then in an oven or another mechanism for regenerating them, and then he rents them out to farmers. So for a week, you can have some beads, you can use them to dry your seed, and you bring them back, and you give them, and then they regenerate them again, and then lend them out to someone else. And so it becomes a business model like that, which makes it much less expensive for the farmer to then, in this case, rent them for a week, as compared to having to invest in buying the beads in the first place. And so we still have work to do to develop these models, but we are working on the economics of that. And so I would encourage you to look at what we have on our website at the moment, and there'll be more coming in the future.
I'd just like to comment that, I mean, this is one of the huge challenges of our scaling out process. We have many, you know, many technologies developed under research conditions that are, you know, highly efficient, and that we have, you know, predictive models that the efficiency upon scale out will the economics will work out. But until we link some of these research projects, which are done on smaller scale, with scaling agents such as mission value chain projects or private sector projects, or let's say a large scale proliferation, working with, let's say, NGOs throughout the countryside, you know, a lot of these highly efficient technologies that do the job in terms of the pest control or could be a food safety aspect, a soil management condition, whatever. We won't really know until the research community forges these important partnerships with the larger scale scaling agents. And this is something, you know, we're struggling with now. In some cases, you can even go from, you know, from lab to land and in one province of a target FDF country, a certain technology proves itself. But we are now in the process of moving, you know, from that province out to, let's say, you know, 10 other provinces in that same country. And, you know, how do you do that? The research projects don't have the bandwidth to do the scaling out, but they have to work with the scaling agents. They have to participate in the process and guide the tweaking of the technologies as they move, let's say, from one province to 10 provinces. Because during that movement, you will have to do research. You will have to do, you know, tweaking. And you'll need researchers to be involved in that tweaking process. So it's going to be the administrator wants a lot more of our technologies to reach you know, many more farms throughout Africa and other countries, in other parts of the world. And in order to do that, we have to forge this relationship between the research projects and the scaling projects. The role of the research researchers in this process is kind of a new terrain for us, but the researchers have to be involved in defining the value propositions for the private sector and the other scaling agents. They have to be involved in that process.
And to add on to that, we just recently posted to AgriLink's blog post around scaling technologies and some additional resources, which the Bureau for Food Security and the Feed the Future Initiative is seeking input on. So there's a number of matrices around the scaling of technologies of different categories. And so if you wanted to look to see what we're looking at, please check out AgriLink's and provide comments on some of those technologies. Do we have another question from online?
Yeah, it's kind of related to what you were just talking about. This one comes from Elizabeth Dunn, president of Impact LLC in Gainesville, Florida. What are the processes used to select crops and technologies for research and development under the horticulture and IPM CRISPs? How much attention is paid to selecting crops and technologies that will benefit the lowest income farmers and traders?
I would say for the Horticulture Innovation Lab, our program is very much focused on smallholder farmers, as stipulated under Feed the Future. And so we're looking to see which crops are of greatest benefit to them. And we tend to focus a bit more on the domestic market, although we also do work on export markets. Part of the reason we focus a bit more on domestic is because it has a dual benefit of benefiting the smallholder farmer, but also increasing the availability of horticultural crops in the local community, which hopefully diversifies diets within the country. But we do focus on crops that are important for consumption by the household and also for income generation.
You know, we work mostly with the high-value vegetable crops and some of the selected fruit crops and address mostly the small-scale farmers. Sometimes the missions come and ask us to address some of the problems that they are having with some different crops like mango in Senegal. Fruit fly is a problem, so they give an associate award for us to work on it. So we do address that one. And in the case of India, you know, they had a invasive species problem, so we address that one for on papaya. And currently we are working on another invasive species, the tuta, that is affecting tomatoes in North Africa.
If I could add just a remark that the level of urbanization, particularly in Africa, has created, I think, a new market and a growing market for certainly the African indigenous vegetables, some of the indigenous tree fruits and nuts, medicinal and aromatic plants that didn't really exist 15 or 20 years ago. And the infrastructure is in place, those domestic markets are in place, and they're becoming a key driver in the generation of those of demand for those systems from urban areas. It is feeding back into the rural areas. So there's we certainly see a shift in the composition of vegetables going into a lot of these open markets in urban areas just because of the growth and the size of those urban markets that is mutually beneficial, I think, in driving the research agenda.
I think what we're trying to do a better job of is that, you know, in the past, many, many research projects, investments were not, essentially synced with field mission priorities, and we're trying to make a big improvement under Feed the Future along those lines, to the point actually where when we are in the design phase of new research projects now, during the procurement phase, during the work planning, that the Feed the Future missions have more say into how some of these research projects should be oriented. It's just been kind of a traditional disconnect for a variety of reasons, but we are really now trying to improve upon that, because we, in order to hit these scaling targets and to get essentially the missions into a position where they will support the research investments, the best ones to be scaled out, we have to have that much more of that initial conferencing and buy-in from the missions in the design phase, not just afterthought of buying into projects through associate awards. We have to get more buy-in initially into the design process. That's what's going on now.
So following up on that point, John, I want to compliment. I'm Deborah Rubin, Director of Cultural Practice, a small company in Bethesda, Maryland. Following up on that point, I want to congratulate AgriLinks for actually bringing together the researchers and the practitioners here in one presentation. And I think that that's a really good start. And clearly, the center programs are doing a number of things to do this. And I'm thinking of the conference that was held in Tanzania earlier in March to bring together researchers as well as the local organizations and the practitioners. Are there any other opportunities like that are coming up, or are there specific missions that you could highlight that are really making an effort to do this in the field with particular either innovation labs or practitioner organizations, consulting organizations. Thanks.
Well, this as I go around the world and monitor the investments that I'm responsible for, this is one of my charges now to get the missions to be more involved. And the Cambodia mission, for example, strikes me as one that's where I was in the field working directly with the mission officer, the ag officer, doing joint visitations between the demonstration farms of the contractor-led projects with some of the researchers who were involved with the IPM Innovation Lab, and trying to make things happen, put things together. And a variety of things did happen that were very positive. I don't have time to explain all of them, but we're trying to repeat that model in a variety of countries. I just bring out Cambodia because I was particularly involved in that particular mission and saw the interaction happening, and then I saw essentially both the research project changing its ways a bit to suit the implementer project, and the implementer project buying in more to the research project, and real synergy starting to happen. So it's not only happening in Cambodia; it's happening in other countries as well. But part of the problem is the contractor-led implementation projects have very difficult targets to reach. The design of the research projects, and to some extent, need to be more flexible. A lot of their dollars are kind of pre-programmed from start to the end of a five-year period, and then you need essentially a lot of goodwill and cooperation and between the ag field officers and the headquarters agricultural officers to all make it happen. So it's starting to happen, and we just hope we can get more good examples of collaboration, as in the Cambodia case.
I'd like to just add that there is going to be another meeting that the Innovation Labs and the Bureau of Food Security are putting together in Ghana that'll be similar to the one that Deb Rubin just mentioned that was in Tanzania last March. This one's going to be in July 8th through 9th.
I think there's also talk about a global learning event or a GLEE event in the area of scaling technologies, where we bring in research projects with the scaling agents. There's talk of that happening later on in this year or early in 2014. That'll be an opportunity for the research projects and the implementation projects to work closely together to hit scaling targets.
We have time for one last question.
Thank you. Antiyama Musada from IFDC VFRC. I know that Feed the Future is bringing a lot of technology, a lot of new seeds, plants. Is the research side interested in all the ecosystem changes that is going to happen in like 10, 20 years when we introduce new seeds, we introduce new pesticide to treat all that we are doing now? How are we going to handle in the future all those transformations to the nature in Africa?
Well, one of the three focal areas of our office right now is sustainable intensification. So we have a whole team of researchers working very hard to achieve intensification of crop production while preserving the whole idea is to do this while preserving the agroecosystems. As I mentioned, we're focused on four agroecosystems. And we have a lot of work in those four alone. But the whole idea is as we use different technologies and approaches and breeding strategies, soil and water conservation strategies to intensively produce the crops, we have to make sure that the ecosystem is preserved. So this is part of the responsibility of the sustainable intensification teams to do this properly. And then they have to have alliances with ecosystem preservation system-wide projects such as integrated pest management or our colleagues in Triple E, where they're working on biodiversity. They all have to form these alliances. But we do have this one big effort in the office, sustainable intensification, which has this charge to be mindful of ecosystem preservation combined with the need to greatly intensify production targets. Anybody else want to comment on that?
I'd just like to say that I really appreciate that comment, because as a research user in our implementation projects, if you take a look at IPM, there's a tremendous amount of maintenance research that needs to be done that's underinvested in at the national system level. And adapting to those changes that occur over a decade's time requires people to be in place. If it's not a sudden transfer of a pest like Tuta absoluta has been over the last 6 or 7 years, that's one point that I think it's that the National Ag Research Systems, which are now focused on breeding seed systems, driven by a lot of investments, sort of need the systemic capacity to do the maintenance research to make those adjustments. The second thing is that we've got a lot of long-term climate impact models. But what we've also had is a reduction in the amount of investment in near-term and medium-term weather forecasting. It certainly has happened in the United States. And one of the issues in terms of getting people to buy into mitigation measures, adaptation measures, is how well you can predict that drought, that those flooding circumstances that you give the dry, wet year shaking of the technologies that you're using, that you have to adapt to in an economic way in a relatively short period of time. I've been trying to advocate for more of the 3-month, 6-month, 9-month forecasting investments in agricultural weather that would provide some of the forecasts necessary, because if you can get people to see that you can forecast at that level, you'll have a better buy-in over the longer term to adapting to those longer-term climate changes. And I think that's a missing area in a lot of the current investment in the climate adaptation mitigation field.
Okay, with that, I'd like to thank our speakers for joining us today. So this event was recorded. We'll make the recording available online, so you can refer to it later or share it with others who might have missed it. And with that, please check out AgriLinks for other information. We've got a variety of blog posts provided by both the Horticultural Innovation Lab as well as the IPM Innovation Lab. So thank you very much and have a good day. Yes, and also as a reminder, we have the IPM Research Priorities e-consultation that's happening next week. So please join us for that as well. All right, thank you very much.